Okay, I have to be honest with you. This is very uncharted territory. It's supremely important for me to help you set the tone for the next week. What I mean by setting the tone is these 2 days, and in particular Yom HaZikaron, are completely and totally unlike anything you've experienced. Namely, there's a reference point for Purim. You've had Purim in Chutz Laaretz, you'll have Purim here. It's different. It's more holistic. It's more comprehensive. But you pretty much get the drill. You've been through Purims before in your life. And similar to Hanukkah and similar to Rosh Hashanah, as intense and as momentous as those experiences were, you have reference points. You have precedent that you can connect to. Yom HaZikaron in particular, and Yom HaTzmud as well, in Israel is completely different than it is in Chutz Laaretz by definition. It's almost impossible to have the same feel of Yom HaZikaron and Chutz Laaretz as you have here, simply because so much of it surrounds actual graves and actual cemeteries and actual tears and actual people and actual families. So as much as you can have in high school with all good intentions, no one is failing, a ceremony or hatikvah or a gathering, the potency and the impact of standing in a cemetery, of hearing from survivors, and to spend, to be honest, maybe just ask, or maybe ask Rabbi Blau, my name, if you could just take the conversation elsewhere with my voice, I don't know if I shout him. I feel after Yom HaZikaron, I feel as if I've been through a mini Yom Kippur. It's very cathartic for me, it's very purging, it's very soulful. And my plea to you is, and my strong recommendation is, completely immerse yourself from Sunday night till Monday night in Yom HaZikaron. Whatever's on the agenda, don't skip anything. Whatever movies will be shown, whatever people will speak to you. To me, the highlight, it's hard to say, but the highlight of your year is being in the cemetery. So no one should not be at the cemetery on Monday. I'll be there with the OU trying to broadcast to a broader English community, so you'll see me there. I just feel like I want to try to bring the experience to as many people as I can. So I plead with you, take it seriously. On the other hand, I'm just very overwhelmed because I've never been through this experience myself. To say that I'm dreading it, I'm not dreading it because I know that it's meaningful. I just don't have a compass. I can't imagine how I'm going to experience Yom HaZikaron with not just the thousands of people that I have to think about, but the tears and the layers of people that are suffering. It's not just like I can hone in, okay, there's X amount of soldiers that died. When you think about the soldiers and the hostages and the evacuees and the people who are ill and the people who have limbs amputated, it's hard to wrap your head around how many people are suffering and how many people are going to be living through their suffering in a collective way in Yom HaZikaron. So I don't know where I'm heading. I also know that I'm very conflicted about Yom HaTzmaut. I think at your level, typically it's just a day of joy. It's a day of celebration, to celebrate independence and sovereignty with everything that it means as a people and religiously. This year, I can't see myself feeling that same joy when there's so much suffering and so many people who can't feel the joy just would feel. But I'm able to put that into perspective. My Yom HaTzmaut, I'm able to say there are two feelings, and at some point they dovetail, because we realize the importance of the Atzmaut and the importance of the State of Israel, where would we be in? And the rabid and rancid anti-Semitism just proves how vulnerable we are without the State of Israel. So I'm able to find that convergence between the celebration and the frustration, because it's just a moment in time in which the two are not yet reconciled. But the Yom HaZikaron is just so massive, and to think about how many people are going to be experiencing their trauma and their suffering. So please take it seriously. Take the next couple of days seriously and find ways to. Another way that I'd recommend, if your Hebrew is all right, then go online and just, whether it's October 7th or not, the minhag here in Eretz Yisrael is that most often you can ask your Israeli friends for help. When a soldier falls, they put out a little video in their memory, a 5-10 minute video. So you can find ways to access that. Again, the Israeli boys will know, Chalalei Tzahal, Sirtonim LeChalalei Tzahal, just type those things in. I'm sure, sadly enough, there are enough soldiers that fell of English-speaking descent, origin, that you can probably find them as well. It just takes a little bit of effort. That's why I put that announcement up today. I'm not trying to hawk my book. She even makes all the proceeds. I'm making nothing on it. But just I want to find ways for you to start getting traction rather than waking up Sunday night and just, you know, I'm traveling to Chutz Laaretz just for a day because it's one opportunity, really, honestly, to bring as many people into this feeling as I possibly can. So let's just talk a little bit tonight, but this is just the tip of the tip of the tip of the tip of the iceberg. The Gemara says in Shabbos, source number 2, that when a person comes to Shemayim, Lasid Lavo, after 120 years, you'll face a battery of questions. We could call this the final test of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The first question is ethics and morality, right? The first question, there can be no religious structure unless the foundation is sturdy, and that sturdiness, the cement bricks, the steel at the foundation is to be a mensch, to act honestly, to show respect to people. I was just filming before a small little video in memory of Rav Lichtenstein, whose yahrzeit is tomorrow, and we'll go to the kever, Mirtz Hashem. I don't know if I could be there. My son's getting inducted in the morning, my flight's at night, but you should all go to the kever and just, you know, not just pay respects, but feel what it is to be part of the community tomorrow. And it's just been a year of such moral confusion and a world which has been photoshopping truth. And any world which loses the capacity to fix north absolute truth from falsified narratives, the entire conversation breaks down. I've imagined so many times being stopped by an anti-Israel protester and say, can you please explain your position? I would say, I can't even begin to explain because the baseline assumptions of our conversation are so different that there's no community, there's no conversation, there's no dialogue. And the Mishnah says in Avos, you all know the famous Mishnah, Shlosha Devarim Halom Omed, Alatara Vodim Yis Chasadim, but we're going to one Mishnah in Avos, Shlosha Devarim Halom Omed, Aladin Vela Emes Vela Shalom. And without their desire for Emes, a pursuit of Emes, an acknowledgement of Emes, everything can be... And I just remembered Rav Lichtenstein's moral clarity and how clear it was, despite his sophistication, despite his shades of gray, and despite his nuance, there are clear moral lines. So you have to abide by clear moral codes and behavior. The second question you'll be asked in Shemayim source number two is Kavati Dimlatara, as we've stressed so often. Without finding Hashem through His Word, the system falls apart. We don't speculate. We don't discover. HaKadosh Baruch Hu revealed Himself to us at Har Sinai. In the Torah lies His Word. Some people study Torah more. Some people study Torah less. But Talmud Torah is not an option. It's not part of the menu. Talmud Torah is the menu of Yiddishkeit. It is the menu of religious identity. You find HaKadosh Baruch Hu by His Word. Echad Amar ve'Echad Amamit. I said it to you often before, and I'll say it again just to create that awareness. You can't be considered a Jewish male unless you study Torah. That shouldn't be a provocative statement. Studying Torah is a mitzvah essay. Being Orthodox means you accept all mitzvah essay. You don't necessarily succeed at every moment in mitzvah essay, but the second you begin selecting or neglecting, that's not Orthodox behavior. Now, are there people who are Orthodox, people who don't learn? Okay, people have excuses, people fall off, people haven't had orientation, but the goal is that your Orthodoxy should incorporate all 613 mitzvahs, of which Talmud Torah is one. I'm not describing the primacy of Talmud Torah, the centrality of Talmud Torah. That's for another time. The third question you'll be asked is, Asakti b'piraviravya. Did you invest in your family? Did you bring children into this world? And did you raise them and nurture them? And Mirza Shem, that's something to talk about one day. People sometimes ask me, how many children should I have in my family? There is only one answer to that question. There's no other answer. There's one answer to that question. How many children should you have in your family? As many as you possibly can. Now, that variable, as many as you possibly can, is affected by a lot of sub-variables. Physical state, medical condition, finances, psychological state, marital state. You need to have a very strong marriage, have a big family. You need to have finances. A lot of the frustration I feel from friends of mine who raise their families in Chutz Laaretz, it's just much more expensive to raise your family in Chutz Laaretz. So part of the privilege of living in Eretz Yisrael, where education is either free or more or less free, where medical coverage is more or less built in, essentially, it's a very kid-friendly environment. Kids can walk freely and run. One of the reasons I made Aliyah is I really wanted a big family. And it's just much easier to have a big family in Eretz Yisrael than it is in Chutz Laaretz. But that's the answer to your question could be, I'm going to have one child. Because, I mean, some people, after they have one child, the woman can no longer, be able, doesn't have the capacity medically. So don't look and judge people. You don't know, you don't go into their bedroom and have conversations with them. But your goal should be to get married, especially at this crucial point in history, to bring as many people into this world as you possibly can, psychologically, emotionally, marrily, economically, whatever. That could differ from person to person. The fourth question everyone will be asked is, Tzipisa LeYeshua, did you wait for Geula? Now that question has radically transformed over the last 76 years, or in a broader sense, the last 120 years. If you go back in time 200 years, when people read this Gemara, you're living in Poland, you're living in Spain, you're living in Turkey, you're living in Alexandria, you're living in London. What can you really do? Tzipisa LeYeshua. You can't take any action. You can't be part of any process. You can't show any courage proactively. All it is to wait and to believe. and waiting and believing is an act of courage and an act of defiance itself. Trust me, the conditions that your great-great-great-great-grandparents had to withstand and the situation and the circumstances they had to suffer, they would eagerly trade places with everyone in this room right now. If they had the choice to exchange their 17th century dreary and bleak reality, or their 14th century living on the run from pogroms after the bubonic plague, or their 12th century life in the hellish environment of the Crusades, or whatever, and they could live in a state of Israel and stand next to soldiers that have a Magen David on their arm sleeve and are Jewish soldiers, I don't know what they would do. I mean, I'd say the phrase cut off their right arms is an expression. Unfortunately, we're still living with the sadness of people who did lose limbs under various conditions. You have to be careful about the words you use, but it's just a way of speaking. They would give any price to trade places with you. So for them, the acts of courage and the maintenance of faith and the belief that we have a future, even when it seemed hopeless, may, who knows, no one can judge anyone's courage, but may exceed any courage and any fortitude than anyone has shown in our generation. I don't know. I'm not part of that reality. I can't go back and live in a shtetl and try to put myself into their space. But either way, it's now a different world. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu's expectation when you come to Shemayim and you answer that question is not just I believed and I waited, but history is literally being written before our eyes. What happens in these years, the same way we go back and talk to the people who lived through the Independence War, we ask them, what was it like? And tell us what it was like to survive the Holocaust. And how did you believe? And what steps did you take? And I smuggled ammunition. And I fought in this war. And I supported. And I drove in buses. Those are the stories that you're going to tell and you'll be asked. And you don't want to be on the sideline and have answers to those stories because you'll be embarrassed historically. So the complexion of that question has completely been altered. Tzipisul Yeshua. The Gemara says that Chizki HaMelech had messianic potential. Mashiach is not a fixed date and it's not a fixed event. It's a potential. And sometimes we meet the potential and sometimes we lose the potential. Unfortunately, we've never met the potential. So for example, there was messianic potential. There was potential for Mashiach when we left Mitzrayim. The original plan of history was that history should end 2,448 years after it began. When I say history, I don't just mean Jewish history, I mean human history. Because when Jewish history is perfected, all of humanity reaches the utopian state of seeing Hashem and enjoying widespread prosperity. We were 11 days away from utopia. That's how long it takes to walk from Har Sinai to Eretz Yisrael. So after Har Sinai, Hashem expected us to enter Eretz Yisrael. Imagine the last 2,500-3,000 years of history was all one big detour. Now, just because it's a detour doesn't mean that it's empty. Human beings create and produce, but the original plan, Plan A, did not include all the historical events that happened over the last 3,500 years. That's all been a historical runaround. Doesn't mean it's empty and vacant, but it's all been an historical detour. And we didn't meet that potential. We failed. We failed in the Ego. We failed in the Meraglim. It could be that some of that potential was reconstituted when David and Shlomo, but we failed during the crisis of David and Shlomo. And then we failed in the second Beis HaMikdash. And then we were exiled for 2,000 years, and now the next period in history with this potential of Mashiach, however long it will take, 10 years, it could take 300 years. But there is potential for historical shift now, and this is the end. This is the final chapter. Final chapter could mean, so I don't like using terms like Reshus V'Chasgul Aseinu, because it evokes issues that are hard for me to deal with, and I'll talk about this later. I say the tefillah also. But I'd rather use phrases that are more vague, that are elastic enough to allow for many, many different scenarios, is that we're in the final chapter of history. We're writing the end. Many things have to happen for that end to occur, but we're in the final, final chapter of history. Now, one of the moments of messianic potential that was squandered was when Chizki HaMelech was miraculously saved. Could you imagine? 180,000 Assyrian soldiers were miraculously, supernaturally eliminated. They laid siege to Yerushalayim. There was no hope. There's nowhere to run. Could you imagine if tomorrow we wake up, or Sunday, Monday, we wake up, and all of the barbarians who are now taking hold in Rafah and waiting to try to battle our soldiers just miraculously disappear? They died in their tunnels, and all the hostages walked free, all the remaining hostages. Could you imagine a miracle? How much hallel we'd say? How thankful we'd be to HaKadosh Baruch Hu? How much celebration there'd be in the streets of Eretz Yisrael? And Chizkiah didn't say shir. He wasn't grateful. And the Gemara doesn't tell us why. Source number one, Bikish HaKadosh Baruch Hu Lasos Chizkiah Mashiach. V'sancheirev Gog U'Magog. And why not? Lefanecha losi. So why not? Uma David Melech Yisrael shamar kama shiros v'tishpachos lefanecha la'asom Mashiach Chizkia shasisa lo kol anisim alalu v'la mashir. Chizkia, quote unquote, failed because he didn't say shir. He didn't thank Hashem. Now the Gemara leaves it very ambiguous why he didn't say shir. That was his failure. But why didn't he say shir? Perhaps, it's not clear from the Gemara. But if you read Tanakh and you read Melachim Beis, you can climb into his head and understand why he didn't say Shira. Because we know the story, we celebrate the story that Pesach night happened, Pesach night, V'hibachatzi al-Layla, 180,000 Assyrian soldiers fell in the battlefield without lifting a sword. But what happened in the lead-up to that miracle? Sennacherib and his armies conquered the entire north of Israel. Sennacherib and his armies emptied the north of Israel of its Jewish population, exiling them to oblivion. Who knows if we'll ever recover 10 of our Shvatim? 80%, close to 80% of our population is lost to history. It's machlokas in the Gemara, whether the Aseres HaShvatim will or will not return to Moshe Mashiach. If you imagine if they come back, they'll be barely Jewish. Nothing that defines us defines them. None of the experiences, none of the halacha, none of the Torah Shebaal Peh. Even if they do come back, it'll be, you're looking across the divide, it always feels very, very foreign. The entire north of the country, the entire Shomron-based capital was destroyed. And it was hard for Chizkiah to imagine a partial redemption. It was hard for Chizkiah to handle triumph and tragedy together. It was hard to celebrate everything that Hashem had delivered in the wake and in the aftermath and in the shadow of such tragedy. Well, we're all in Chizkiah's position this year. There's so much tragedy and there's so many people who suffered and there's so much uncertainty about the future. Just today, there's a violent, violent skirmish up north, where there was a barrage of 30 or 40 rockets. And Baruch Hashem, I say Baruch Hashem, if people were still living there, who knows how many casualties and injuries there would be. And they're not living there, which itself is tragic. It's fun to stay in a hotel for a week or 2 weeks. It's not fun to spend an entire half a year with your family in one or two hotel rooms. There are huge, huge traumas that we're dealing with. The amount of families and divorces that are taking place in hotels. It's not a natural setting to conduct a family life. Baruch Hashem, they're there. Because if they wouldn't be there, God forbid, what would have happened this morning and all the other innumerable days? But try to find the space where you're able to be grateful for what we have while not ignoring or neglecting the partiality and the frustration. The Gemara says in Bava Basra, okay, it sounds strange, don't apply this in our day, but in the Gemara's context it made sense, that if your wealthy relative passes away, you recite two brachas. First you recite a bracha Dayan HaEmes, like you recite any time someone passes. Then the next bracha you recite, which again, in our situation, wouldn't be polite, but their customs and mores were different. The second bracha you recite is, Hatov Yameitev, or Shechianu, because you've now come to a great inheritance. And how could you recite Hadayin HaEmes and Tov Yameitev together? Again, today we wouldn't recite those brachas because it would seem greedy, but in those days, finances had a different feel to them. Evidently, HaKadosh Baruch Hu expects us to feel multiple emotions at once. Avraham Avinu stood at Har Moriah, and he was terrified of losing his son, but he's also thrilled to perform the will of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Chazal say. He was crying, but he was happy. So Hashem expects us to process multiple emotions. And you know what? In life, you'll have that. Life is always complex. When you're young, you feel that life is black or white, good or bad, happy or sad. And as you grow older, you realize life is just very, very complex. And at your moment of greatest happiness, there's sadness. And at your moments of sadness, you find happiness and support and consolation from people. And what's happening at an individual level now is being played out at a broader level, at a grand scale. So just because it's partial, doesn't mean it's not Yad Hashem. And just because it was a terrible defeat 7 months ago, doesn't mean it's not Yad Hashem. And Shir HaShirim, Shir HaShirim is the book that describes our great love between Am Yisrael and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And it is metaphorized through a man and a wife. And if you understand Shir HaShirim, you know Jewish history. It's a very, very hard sefer to read. Mirtz Hashem, as the years go on, I expect you to invest. Rabbi Akiva called the Kodesh Kadashim. Rabbi Akiva called Shir HaShirim Kodesh Kadashim. Why is it Kodesh Kadashim? There are no halachos. There's no migo. There's no sharmua. There's no bor in Shir HaShirim. There's no halachos. The answer is feeling part of Jewish history, understanding where you come from, and understanding who you're part of, and understanding the tragedy and the beauty of Jewish history, the beauty that we were chosen, the tragedy that we've had to cobbled together our relationship after it was ruptured. Understanding that and placing yourself into that march, into that process, That's your source of Kedusha. Just like you can find Kedusha by opening up a Sefer Torah, learning a piece of Torah, there's Kedusha to Am Yisrael. That's what this yeshiva is premised upon. There are two sources for Kedusha. One is the eternal word of Hashem, which is beyond time and beyond space. And you can read it on an island. And then Mirtash Hashem Liyasud Lavo and Olam Haba will still be learning Torah. And then there's Jewish history. There's a beauty in the Kedusha of being part of this process and understanding how much it's taken from our people. And here's the second part, and work on this week, and being able to translate that into Avas Yisrael. Some people have an easy time with Jewish history, but have a hard time with Jews. If you are invested in Jewish history, you love Jews as well, even if you disagree with them ideologically, and even if sometimes they don't live up to your expectations, as Jews sometimes do or don't. So if you believe in Jewish history, you have to translate that into Avas Yisrael. Because these are the people. Mashiach's not going to come and select out all the Hasdarniks and discard everyone else. Mashiach's going to come to an entire people. Our entire nation will be redeemed. People that are vastly different from you, without getting into the question of how we interpret Eil ve'ilu divrei Elokim Chayim. And it's so important, especially during this period. I know it's difficult. And I know I hear people talking about this sect of Jews and that sect of Jews. And we've seen the entire gamut. We've seen Jews who are opposed to the state of Israel. We've seen people who are protesting against our soldiers. They're also Jews. The only people who abdicate are people that literally those nut jobs who stand alongside of Hamas terrorists in Iran. They're not Jewish. They've turned their backs on Jews. They're masquerading as Jews. You can't eat their shechita. You can't drink their wine. You can't marry their children. They've walked out of Jewish history. But the people who are protesting in their minds, the legacy of Avraham Avinu demands that they be moral. And in their minds, morality, absent of any divine prophecy, means that we can't be fighting this war. We believe that alongside of morality, there are divine promises that we have to be sensitive to, and we have to try to find a way to juggle and synthesize the two as best we can. But in their minds, they're pursuing, and they'll be part of our ghoul as well. They haven't walked out just because they are acting in ways that are so offensive to us. So try to translate it. So in Shir HaShirim, which is a book of Jewish history, Hashem is actually compared to an animal, which is audacious. Nowhere in Tanakh is there any image associated with Hashem. That's an anathema to monotheism. Hashem has no image. The only image to describe Hashem's arrival is a cloud, the distortion of image. No image. You can't see anything. They're not a kavod. The anan comes down. There's nothing that is associated with Hashem. The only time in all of Tanakh that Hashem has an image is in Shir HaShirim, because in Shir HaShirim we're Hashem's wife. And marriage is based on parity. When there's parity, just like we're compared to doves, Yonasi b'chag v'hasela b'seisa madriga, we have the right to compare our husband to an animal. What is Hashem compared to in Shir HaShirim? Anyone know? Which animal? I'll start. The pasuk Dome Dodi Litzvi O Leofer Hayalim Al Harivater. Baruch Hashem is compared to a gazelle or a deer. Why is Hashem in Shir HaShirim compared to a deer? So Chazal says, source number 5, Dome Dodi Litzvi. Who remembers the last time you saw a deer when you were in the country? And you called your parents, and you called your sister, and you called your brother, and you said, look, there's a deer out there, look out there. By the time they came to the kitchen or to the back patio, the deer disappeared. Deer didn't go anywhere. It's just hiding behind the bush. It's no longer visible. If you wait a couple of minutes, the deer comes out. Chazal say, that's how Geula will be. You'll see HaKadosh Baruch Hu's hand, and then the hand will disappear. But then it will reappear. For the last 7 months, it's been very hard to see the Yad Hashem. 1948, it was easier to see the Yad Hashem. 1967, it was right there. The last 20, 30 years, 40 years since 1967, the meteoric rise of our people and of our nation, and we became a military superpower, an economic giant, and we absorbed Jews. If you ask me, one of the most momentous events, don't just gauge Israeli success based on military victories and economic success. One of the most transformative events, and I'll talk about this on Yom Yerushalayim if we have some time, in the entire history of the state of Israel, was Russian Aliyah. As Americans and North Americans, you're more centered on the West. But do you know what it was like to absorb 1.5 million high caliber, educated people, refined? Not to say that we don't take everyone in. And it was just as exhilarating in what's it called? Magic carpet, Mirvad HaKesamim, to take Yemenite Jews out of stress, and Operation Shlomo to take Ethiopian Jews. But when you take people from depressed economies without education, it stresses the system. It's our responsibility to stress the system. We're not here in this country to build build suburbia. We're here to build a historical project. And whatever challenges it takes, that's our responsibility. We're not here for comfort. We're here for history. But taking in 1.5 million Russians, that's what transformed the economy. I was here when I sat where you're sitting right now in the 80s. You know how much a bag of milk cost? There's still bags. I don't know if they sell bags anyway. You know how much a bag of milk cost? 50,000 shekel. And the next day it cost 80,000 shekel. That's how runaway the inflation was. We used to run in the morning after davening to the makolet to try to buy food at yesterday's prices because they hadn't had the chance to raise the prices based on overnight inflation so we could get a 20% discount, right? The cereal would cost 50,000 shekel, but really it cost 70,000. We paid 50,000 with more deflated income. And at some point, and they were right, we were just kids, we didn't know, someone said that's not right, that's not moral. The makolet is not here so that rich Americans get richer. The makolet is here to support locals who are barely scraping by, including the makolet owner. So the rule was we could not go to the makolet till 10:30, till they could readjust the prices. Runaway inflation. I used to walk, you know why I have so many svarim? I would walk into a svarim store and flash $10 and say, just give me the dollars and take as many svarim as you want into your bag. Because shekels were worthless. They weren't worth the paper they were printed on. And if you had dollars, there were prices in dollars. The entire country had prices. You walk into a store, you saw prices in dollars. How did the country change? It's a very complicated question. But part of it was, in the 90s, absorbing all these educated, quality, upper-scale people. It lent a jolt and it electrified the economy. And it essentially cultivated the startup nation. We're a startup nation in part, not only because of all that influx of tech and science and math from the former Soviet Union. So you can't just gauge the success of our people through military victories or through population increases. You have to see how the country has changed. So it's so easy to see Hashem's hand. And then 6-7 months ago, October 7th, I still feel HaKadosh Baruch Hu's hand over the last 6 months, but it's harder. You have to see it through the cracks. I saw HaKadosh Baruch Hu's hand 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago, and we woke up with all the missiles, and who even knew? Who even knew that we had that technology? Of course, we've been working on it for 20 years, and of course, there were news items, but no one really paid attention. They weren't front-lobe issues. You know what it is to wake up and to face that type of barrage? And Baruch Hashem, we have already built-in capacity to defend ourselves. I felt HaKadosh Baruch Hu's hand on October 7th. You all know the dastardly, sinister plans of these rapists and murderers. They had every intention. They were equipped and well-planned. My son-in-law told me, he was one of the first responders to Kfar Aza. He cleaned out Kfar Aza, eliminating terrorists on day 2. Literally on Sunday, he was there. He told me that they recovered Hamas guidebooks and Hamas schedules. And they were so planned that they had it down to the hour. From 9 to 10, kill as many Jews as you can in this sector of the kibbutz. And then at 10 o'clock, stop and recite the following pasuk from Quran. And then from 10 to 11, do this. Literally the schedule. And part of their itinerary, God forbid, chas v'shalom, was to cut through the heart of the country, ignite a firestorm in the shtachim, and then elicit Hezbollah attack from the north. Do you know what we could have been facing? I don't mean to mitigate or to diminish the suffering that we went through, but it wouldn't have been 1,500 people. The numbers would have climbed astronomically, and who knows where we'd be as a state. And why didn't Hezbollah attack? Why were they thwarted? Of course, they were thwarted because of heroism of people who sacrificed their lives, ordinary citizens who jumped in cars and just went down and formed ad hoc units to defend southern communities with the interim battle. And police women and policemen who lost their lives knowing that they were going to lose their lives, but holding out to the last bullet in police stations in Sderot and in Kitot Konanot and various kibbutzim. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu protected us in ways that we may never find out, we may never fully appreciate. So I feel, it happened October 7th. Many of you were not here last year. Many of you were not here to feel the pain and the horror of social discord. Our country was terribly split. The protests were horrific. The things were people saying about one another, and I want to make this very, very clear. I've said this for 30 years, but I'll say it again, and you better listen to this and apply this the rest of your life. the prospect, especially post October 7th, doesn't need October 7th, but especially for all the people who didn't get the memo beforehand, the notion that a Jew could refer to another Jew as a Nazi, to me, that mouth should never again say Torah or Davin. Anything that comes out of that mouth is contaminated. How could you use that term about anyone? The only reference point to me are the Hamas barbarians, because they acted in that way for that one day, for those 6 hours. To call another Jew that term, people were freely saying, at protests, and not Rabbona Shel Olam. Had the attack happened 6-7 months later, who knows how badly we would have been split. Would we even have been capable of banding together and unifying last minute to defend ourselves? I don't know. So you can see HaKadosh Baruch Hu in small details, but in the large details it's not always easy, but that doesn't mean we aren't part of a process. And that was Chizkiah's error. He was unable to juxtapose the defeat of the north with the triumph in Yerushalayim. Try to find a way to juxtapose the triumph of everything we've had over the last hundreds of years, the aloneness that our grandparents felt. This is the first pogrom in history that was followed by a war. In previous pogroms, there's nothing. Imagine living through the Holocaust and returning, those of you who went to Poland, and returning to your community, having lived through hell, and then facing a pogrom from your neighbors, which in many ways was worse than Hitler. Imagine not having a place to live because of immigration bans and restrictions, both before. How many lives could have been saved without the very rigid and harsh immigration bans in the United States, in London, in the UK, and of course in Palestine? How many millions of Jews could have been saved? Imagine the aloneness. We're not alone. We have our people, we have our country, we have our army, and every Jew in New York, and every Jew in Los Angeles, and every Jew knows that, and knows that this is, they're literally, I was in America, there are literally people who are buying up apartments in Israel, just to have a safe haven to run to. Even if you're not buying an apartment, you know that as bad as it gets, you are not alone. You have a place to go, and an army to defend you. So try to find a way to juxtapose the suffering, and to juxtapose. I want to end, I don't know how much time we have, I only have 5 minutes. I want to end with a pasuk in Zechariah that Rav Amital would often cite to us. Pasuk in Zechariah, it's a very well-known pasuk. Od Yeshvu Zekenim, Zekenos, Berechovos Yerushalayim, it's pasuk number 6. The Ishmish Anto Biadom Yorv Yamim. One day the streets of Yerushalayim will be filled with children playing, with older people walking on their sticks, on their canes. And remember, Zechariah is an apocalyptic sefer. It talks about apparitions in heaven, about golden candelabras, about mysterious horsemen, about carpenters. It's a very, very apocalyptic sefer. What's so apocalyptic about these scenes? These are pastoral, normal scenes. Older people need canes. Younger kids run through the streets. The answer is, what is normal for every nation is apocalyptic for our nation, because we are not a normal nation. Nothing about the last 6 months surprises me. Am I surprised that there's such interest in this country? Of course not. It's the land of Hashem. Am I surprised that there's such hatred to the Jewish people? Of course not. Look at the last 2,000. It's frustrating. It's irritating. It's infuriating. Nothing. I would be surprised if it didn't exist. Because we're chosen by Hashem to represent Him. And we're a stubborn people because we represent Hashem. And it elicits hostility for all the reasons that I'm not going to get into now without dissecting anti-Semitism. But nothing in the context of the last 2,000 years of history surprised. I'm not surprised by anything that's happening. It's anger. It angers me. But it doesn't surprise me. And Zechariah tells us what's normal for every nation. You go to Scotland, there are old people with canes. You go to Denmark, there are young people. It doesn't have to be an issue. I don't have to defend my survival. I don't have to defend my right to exist as a Dane. It's my country, and I have a right to exist. Only in this country, only in this parcel of land, only with HaKadosh Baruch Hu's chosen people, Are those issues even questions? Because the hatred against us is a hatred against Hashem. It's subliminal. You're not going to interview a college campus anti-Semite and say, what I really dislike is religion and Hashem's presence. But there are certain subliminal, subconscious forces that shape human behavior. It's not just free will. There are forces built into nature. But one day, we still don't have it. In the north, we still don't have it. Just think about this pasuk. The kids who can't walk around freely in the north, and the kids who can't walk around freely in the south. And the older people, think about all the Holocaust people, Holocaust survivors who were caught in the flood of October 7th, and the hostage, I forget his name, who's actually a Holocaust. Maybe I'm planning my family party for Yom HaTzmaut with the rest of my family, and I'm trying very hard. We need to have some tochen. We can't just get together and have a mongol and have a couple of beers and say Shir HaMalos. So maybe take a moment and read up on a hostage in lieu of this week. Maybe take a moment and see a story of a soldier. Maybe take a moment and see a story of people who are heroically defending our people. It doesn't just have to be sadness. But try to create imagery that is not just a day for you to have a couple extra hot dogs, a couple extra hamburgers. That's very passe. You're not going to be happy afterwards. Fill it with tochen. Od Yeshu Zakenim and Zakenos Berchovas Yerushalayim. One day they will sit. One day Rav Amital told us that when he escaped the Holocaust and he lived in Givat Mordechai, and he attended the Hebron Yeshiva. He would walk every day to Yeshiva. He lived in Givat Mordechai. He attended the Yeshiva. And on his way to Yeshiva, he would pass a playground. And he would see little kids playing on the playground. And he would stand there for hours and hours just crying. Because those same eyes that had witnessed little children being thrown into mass graves or piled up like sardines or gassed to death like animals or shot in quiet forests with no one watching them and no one burying them. Now those eyes were witnessing the Nevuah of Zechariah. The children were playing. But like any Nevuah, it's not going to happen easily. It's going to be a struggle. And we're still struggling. And listen to how Hashem describes this normal scene of people growing old. Source number 6, the next pasuk that you don't often quote. Ko Amar Hashem Tzevakos, Hashem says, source number 6, Ki Yipolei Be'inei She'eres HaMazeh. People who will live to the end of history, She'eres HaMazeh, that's who we are. We're She'eres HaMazeh. We've survived history. We're living to the end of history. For whatever reason we were chosen, we're not in Kishinev suffering a pogrom, we're not in Damascus, we're not in Spain, we're not in Poland, we're not suffering a Chavinist game. We are living through She'eres HaMazeh. We are the people Hashem chose. They will be shocked. Ki Yipolei. Listen to the end of the pasuk. Hashem says, Gam Be'ina Yipolei. Num Hashem. I'll also be shocked. Now that's hyperbole. Nothing shocks Hashem. Hashem knows everything in advance. It's hyperbole. Hashem says, I'll also be shocked and baffled and confused about the end of days. So Hashem is telling us it's not always going to be clear. It's in that space that faith sets in. And that's why you need to have such strong faith, is as strong as the people who model it for you. That's my way of telling you, Rav Aaron's famous article, the source of faith is faith itself. That's a modern way to say it. Rav Aaron had a play on words, the source of faith is faith itself. If you look at the article, he basically is saying, what's his faith based upon? The three Ravim of his that gave him faith. And for the last 6 months, I've turned back to the people who gave me faith, trying to strengthen my own emunah, trying to strengthen my own commitment, trying to share it with other people, trying to give strength to people through my own emunah. So that's why it's so important that you draw faith from people. It could be Rebbeim, it could be parents, it could be people you read about, but build it. Faith is something to build, and it allows you to outlast the vicissitudes and the fluctuations of life, whether those vicissitudes are at a personal level or those vicissitudes are at a national level. You're the generation that has been through two upheavals during your formative years. Who even remembers Corona? We thought that would be the event of your life, you would tell your grandchildren. Who even remembers Corona? Because the next upheaval made us forget the previous upheaval. This is the story you'll tell. This is the year to begin to take that pen and just appreciate how you're writing the story. Because what you'll experience over the next week, it's inaccessible outside of Israel. It's a different beast. It's a different experience. Take the time, invest, read, look at the internet. The more you put in, the more that when you stand at 11 o'clock, 11 o'clock on Monday, that's the apogee. 11 o'clock on Monday, when the siren goes off and you're standing in a cemetery with our people of all walks in life, different soldiers, I mean, I literally have to hold back the tears when I say, I don't even know what I'm going to feel this year, because normally it's tears of pride. This is going to be tears of anguish. When I see a soldier and I imagine, what would my grandparents say if they saw a Jewish soldier? When soldiers came to town, they're terrified. Soldiers could rape and kill and burn and kidnap and do whatever they want. No response. Jews were punching bags for soldiers. And you had to see a soldier with tzitzis or without tzitzis. As we say in Hebrew, I'll teach you a nice Israeli term. With a kippah, you ever heard this term? Or with a kippah shkufa. You know what a kippah shkufa is? It's a nice way of saying a transparent kippah. You can't really see it, but it's there. Okay, so that's the way I like to refer to them. Yesh lovshim kippot, v'yesh lovshim kippot shkufot. So it's still there. I don't care. To be able to stand, my legs tremble. I'm literally shaking. You'll see the planes flying overhead, literally during the siren. And hopefully everything that you've worked towards this year, this other reservoir of Kedusha. There's one reservoir of Kedusha, which is the Torah and the mitzvot and the davening. There's another reservoir of Kedusha, which is your people, its history, and the history that we're living right now and that we're paying such a steep price for. But unfortunately, the land of Hashem is not easily won. Okay, guys? Have a meaningful week.